I will just present. We are here, Maribel Passarín from the Agencia de Salud Pública de Barcelona. And myself is Angelina González. I'm from Agencia de Salud Pública de Catalonia. So now we have with us Mohamed Surai-Basiet. He's going to present responding to COVID-19 pandemic in Malaysia, roles of risk communication and health promotion initiatives. I think you can go ahead now.
All right. First of all, thank you very much, Mrs. Moderators. Hi, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and good evening from Malaysia. Actually, it's 8 p.m. in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. I'm Effendi. We'll present today on behalf of Director, Health Education Division, Ministry of Health Malaysia. My presentation today is about responding to pandemic COVID risk communication and health promotion initiative in Malaysia. As we are aware, in 2020, a significant threat to public health emerged. The novel severe acute respiratory syndrome epidemic outbreak emerged in December 2019 from Wuhan City, China, and spread to the rest of the world, including Malaysia. Malaysia has implemented many public health interventions and facilitated inter-agency collaborations prior to seeing the first imported case. Among those responses, including increasing surveillance at the point of entry, enhancing laboratory capability and capabilities for case detection, activating public health teams, and triggering hospital case management. However, for these presentations, I aim only to highlight major risk communications and health promotion initiatives undertaken to contain that COVID-19 transmission in Malaysia. Although the cases are not yet well contained due to emergence of new variants of concerns, we actually significantly has flattened the curve in several instances. Ladies and gentlemen, for the background, on the 3rd February 2020, first Malaysian test positive for COVID-19. The patient has history of attending a conference in Singapore involving international delegates from China. So Malaysia records its first human-to-human transmissions later that day. Till then, COVID-19 in Malaysia has evolved within 3 waves. First wave infections in January 2020 to February 2020, second wave from February 2020 to September 2020, and latest third wave from September last year and still active until today. So the government has applied a tiered restriction approach on all states in Malaysia under a movement control order, conditional control movement control order, and recovery movement control order. To date, there is more than 500,000 positive cases reported accumulative in Malaysia, with more than 3,000 deaths in total. Ladies and gentlemen, so overall, how we are communicating the risk and promoting the preventive measures to the mass publics in Malaysia? We crafted the messages and planned their dissemination as they evolve according to the COVID-19 infection wave. Meaning to say that the risk communication and health promotion plans are not static, and we are fully dynamic to accord with current situation of the COVID-19 transmission nationwide. Our risk communication practices during this pandemic follows the principles of highlighted as in the slides. The first, the messages are credible and consistent across all channels because we source the information from credible sources, which is WHO, experts, and current issues from rumor surveillance and feedback channels. We make sure that publics are frequently updated with the latest information via daily press conferences and press statements made by a single source, who is our director of health. With regards to the feedback from the publics in timely response, using dedicated portals, hotlines, and also other channels of communication at various levels. All information and message we crafted are taking into account the facts and figures crucial to the broadcaster and in various languages because Malaysia are multi-ethnicity nations. Apart from utilizing technology to disseminate the information and messages, we also engage and mobilize the community to make them empower to further prevent the transmission of the COVID-19 infection into the local communities. There are several health promotion strategies we follow as proposed by Ottawa Charter and other declaration, including health promotion strategic planning. We create public policy, including guidelines and protocol to follow on a new norms and standard operating procedure, especially during movement control order. We promote, educate, and disseminate information and messages through various channels. We build capacity of the health agents on the level community level. We advocate and collaborate with numerous agency entities and parties across health fields and ministries to understand the impact and to gather evidence-based for further actions. We do monitoring and evaluation through social listening regulations and social media sentiment analysis regularly. Ladies and gentlemen, we set objectives based on the current situations in Malaysia and focus on various target groups like general publics, patients, e-hailing users, tourists or travelers, and so on and so forth. Among those objectives we set are to break the chains of transmissions, to promote public adherence behavior to the new norms SOP, to create general awareness and preventive behavior, to practice healthy lifestyle, to accept COVID-19 vaccination, to set positive attitude and trust on the government initiative and others, including motivations to healthcare workers and families. To date, we published more than 500,000 health materials in form of infographics, videos, poster, and outdoor media, as well as talk show that we broadcasted in various channels. Not to forget to say that we use face-to-face communication as well, like town hall, press conferences, as well as outreach activity to certain localities when necessary. Well, the most crucial piece of work to deal with when managing risk communication and health promotions related to COVID-19 is actually to craft the correct, appropriate, and trustworthy instant and comprehensible messages that tailor to the actual needs of intended target groups. Realizing this matter, we crafted and designed our risk communication messages on COVID-19 based on the pandemic phase as shown in the slides. During the preparation phase, to educate and general awareness, to promote preventive behaviors, prompt and frequent updates related to pertinent issues, manage fake news and false information. While at the early phase, apart from initiatives mentioned in the preparation phase, we also improve healthcare service delivery motivation to the healthcare provider and publics. Likewise, in the late containment and recovery phase, we focus our initiative on motivations of healthcare, reducing fear and stigma, practicing healthy lifestyles, empowering community to embrace new norms, educating on SOP and enforcement. Last but not least, for the mitigation phase, we focus promoting vaccine registrations and vaccinations, building capacity among health agents and community, reducing pandemic fatigue, promoting self-protection, self-lockdown, and last but not least, broadcasting real-life situation. Ladies and gentlemen, as to be fast, instant, and up-to-date, we disseminate information through various channels and media, mainly social media like portals, Facebook, Twitter, Telegram, YouTube, and Instagram, due to the fact that Malaysia has high numbers of social media network users, which is more than 30 million, with the overall internet penetrations of 94%. Nevertheless, we also rely on conventional media because there are areas of the catchment that beyond the proper internet connection, so that people there get more access to TV and radio more often as opposed to social media. To date, our health promotion messages on COVID-19 has reached more than 580 million reaches on the social media itself. On the conventional media, we managed to handle talk show more than 6,000 slots. And not to forget, we also publish printed media specifically to those inclined to use them, in total more than 500,000 copies of any sort. All right, in total, actually, in relation to COVID-19 pandemic, community engagement for sure can be critical for creating local and specific context solution to prevent and control responses. Through this bottom-up approach, community participate in decision-making processes of planning, design, governance, and delivery of services aimed to improve population health and reducing health inequalities. In total, nearly 400,000 community engagement activity carried out involving more than 1 million individuals. We also actively train more than 200,000 for a community to be health agent so that they can themselves disseminate particular message on COVID-19 preventions and influence the local community to follow SOP as to combat further transmission through communication for behavioral impact committee, health community nation building cost plan, health promotion in learning institution program, community representative councils, veteran groups, and other many others, if I may mention them all. Obviously, These initiatives are not played alone by the Ministry of Health, but involve collaborative efforts by many non-health entities and institutions outside government as a whole. It is based solely on the whole of government and whole of society approach. Ladies and gentlemen, another aspect of risk communication that we focus is a dedicated program of this district risk reduction program, or DRRP, in order to protect family, community, districts, as well as others individual related for being infected with the COVID-19. This special program has two folds: to promote the notions of protecting own group district, the district that without any active COVID-19 cases from being infected, but also if the districts already have cases, the local community will be equipped with particular knowledge and skills to return to the yellow status, to the, from yellow status to green status within 14 days. Moreover, as the government give more stress on nationwide measures to contain further spreads of COVID-19 transmission in the community, the state of emergency was proclaimed. The proclamations give benefit to us because all agencies, be them government as well as non-government agencies, can be more dedicated and focused to disseminate and communicate pertinent information to the whole of population through national media and platform collectively. Since the emergence of COVID-19 last year, we conducted a series of surveys to measure and to evaluate the effects of our initiative on risk communication and message dissemination. These two are important social listening triangulations that we based several studies on new norms, adherence, and vaccine acceptance and refusal among Malaysians. We understand that Malaysians in general are aware and well-equipped with preventive measures to control the transmissions of the COVID-19 in the community. They have knowledge on hand washing, social distancing, wearing masks, and other preventive measures. We're also aware that we must prepare to address the hesitancy and build vaccine literacy so that the public will accept immunizations when appropriate. Realizing this matter, we continue to listen to people's aspirations through various series of surveys on vaccine acceptance and refusal as highlighted in the slides. Okay, well, like other parts of the world, although we Malaysia has succeeded to stop the humongous Nipah outbreak virus way back in 1998, we continually face issues and challenges.
Sorry to tell you, you have only one more minute, just because otherwise the other ones wouldn't be able to.
All right, this is my final slide. So basically, our greatest challenge during this pandemic COVID in Malaysia is to ensure people understand and adopt preventive measures. So that's why we're crafting and constructing specific messages that is an other task that we need to perform. We need to team up properly in the development required for accurate information to be provided for the public as a whole. Inculcating new behavior is also the greatest challenge, as we are aware, as adoptions of new behaviors does not happen in short time. And the COVID-19 is a pandemic that is new to us. So adoption of new behavior is a great challenge to us. Identifying and responding immediately to rumors and also misinformation was essential. It was necessary to feed the public with reliable and credible information because to dispel such rumors and ensure public trust and confidence at all time towards the stakeholders and health authorities managing the pandemic. So with that, I thank you very much.
Thank you for your very interesting presentation. Now we're gonna have Samuel from the University of Greifswald, Germany. He's gonna present examining the association between compliance with behavioral recommendations, risk perception, and stigmatizing attitudes during the COVID-19 outbreak.
Okay, so thank you for the introduction. I'm happy to present some of the findings of our research during the COVID-19 outbreak. As you can see, we have a quite long title here, but it also contains all of the elements that we looked at in our research. So the main focus was behavioral recommendations. So infection prevention measures, so to speak, and the intentions to comply with them during the early phases of the COVID-19 outbreak. We investigated a German sample where previous pandemics were not very common, so a lot of things were new for the German public, so it was of particular interest for us to see how they reacted to these recommendations and how fast they would adapt them. And as core constructs here, we looked at risk perception, because previous research points to risk perception as a main variable in behavior change regarding the uptake of infection prevention measures. And we also investigated stigmatizing attitudes. In the following minutes, I will present some of the background and some of the findings of our research here. We started by looking at behavioral prevention. We know that behavioral compliance is related to a reduced infection rate, and we know that health promotion efforts regarding behavioral prevention can be a very successful route to contain the pandemic or contain the spread of the virus. So several, as you can see below, several scientific studies have already looked at the connection between behavioral measures and then infection prevention. And we find that hybrid policies that connect mandatory policies, for example, wearing masks, face masks in specific places, and voluntary hygiene policies seem to be most promising for infection prevention. And we also found when looking at the literature that complex behavioral patterns, so including multiple behaviors, for example, wearing masks, but also practicing hand hygiene together, were not very well researched. So the aspect of complex behavioral patterns are under researched and still are under researched. Most research reports simple prevalences for single behaviors, but does not compute combined scores or look at different scores together. And in the same vein, perceived barriers to compliance are rarely investigated. Most focus on facilitators, but barriers are under-researched. So previous research shows that about 50% show non-compliance when looking at multiple behaviors simultaneously. So people tend to explore one behavior or the other, but seldom both or multiple. This led to our research question what psychosocial predictors we could find of non-compliance that could be addressed in future interventions. The other aspect we wanted to look at is the aspect of stigmatization and COVID-19. Till now, it has received some attention in research regarding stigmatizing, for example, regarding healthcare workers or persons of Asian descent, for example, that have been discriminated against due to their ethnicity, for instance, regardless of their infection status. And the anticipated stigma of infections is also associated with negative psychosocial outcomes, for example, shame, fear, or psychosocial stress for persons. So there are different types of stigmatization here, the anticipated stigma of COVID-19 infections, but also the stigmatization of people with different indicators that are connected to public perceptions of COVID-19. And on a whole, stigmatization can lead to discriminatory activities and actions on individual, social, and societal levels, and thus is a global threat, an additional threat here in the area of COVID-19. So the additional question here was how stigmatization might affect behavioral compliance or non-compliance. As you can see below is just a short model that illustrates the association processes of different aspects of stigmatization. So labeling people according to, for example, the impression they make or symptoms that they have, stereotyping them as belonging to a certain group, being dangerous or, for example, unreliable, separating oneself from them, building a bridge or a distance between them, and then discriminating against them. Worst case scenario, for example, being violent against people from other groups or people that are stigmatized. Built on the research in this area, we came to propose two different pathways that we wanted to investigate of stigmatization on behavioral compliance, where one was a more positive functioning aspect of stigmatization and the other was a more negative one, meaning that stigmatization could increase behavioral compliance via othering processes where an in-group that is not infected wants to comply and wants to distance themselves from other people who they deem infected or at risk for infections. So stigmatization of people who are potentially infected could lead to or could be an expression of people wanting to distance themselves from others who are not compliant. And the other way around, if people are not infected and do not want to be associated with other people who are infected, it could also mean that stigmatization reduces behavioral compliance because showing behavioral measures, for example, wearing a face mask in public could indicate symptoms or being potentially at risk for an infection and thus being part of the outgroup that one does not want to be a part of or doesn't want to be associated with. So these are two potential pathways of stigmatization and behavior that we proposed or that we were looking at and that previous research has pointed us to. In the research I'm presenting today, we looked at a sample of the German public, I already mentioned this, which we collected in March 2020, just after the first lockdown, a few days after the first lockdown started. We collected some socio-demographic data of the sample, for example, age and gender. We measured stigmatizing attitudes towards other people, so we measured structural stigma or the support for discrimination, which means that people with certain markers, for example, in this case, people with COVID-19 infections should not hold public office or should not be allowed to have certain opportunities in public, so structural aspects, but also blame. People are to blame for their infection and it is their responsibility. We also measured risk perception, so people's perceived susceptibility regarding an infection and also their anticipated fear regarding COVID-19 infections. And as the behavioral outcome or a proxy for behaviors, we looked at intentions in this case because this was so early on and these were just communicated. We collected 9 different recommendations that were officially issued by governments or governmental representations. And we dichotomized them into very high intentions versus lower intentions because we assume that only very high intentions to comply with a behavior can result in successful infection prevention. If you only sometimes wear a mask or sometimes avoid hand contact or practice hand hygiene, it is not really successful in containing the spread of the virus. As a statistical analysis tool, we used latent class analysis to capture the complexity of behavioral compliance. This is again just a snapshot of the results, but as you can see here, we found 3 different groups who are quite different in regard in different indicators. If we were just using mean prevalences or let's say mean values, it would not be possible to differentiate between these groups. So we can see that there are some people who have rather high values for almost all behaviors, which is good. So they intend to be very compliant with these recommendations, but these are just about 25% of the sample that we examined. The majority, which we labeled public compliance here, has high values to comply with aspects like staying home or practicing social distancing, as it was called back then, avoiding mass events, for example, but then lower for frequent ventilation or reducing skin contact. And another group that we labeled low compliance is this one you can see here. This had rather low to moderate values for all the behaviors. So the intentions were not very high in this group, except for the covering up when sneezing, which was probably easier to do. So this is a different look at behavioral compliance or at behavioral measures. We do not look at simple values of prevalences for single behaviors, but we combine them and see how many people are really ready to comply with most or all of these measures, which is important for successful prevention. In a subsequent regression analysis, we looked at associations between these variables and latent class. And here we can see some significant associations, which I have noted in the table. So for example, age was significantly associated with compliance, meaning that younger people were more likely to be low compliant or to belong to the class of low compliance. So more risky behaviors or a less likelihood of complying with recommendations was associated with younger age and also with male gender, as you can see here. So males and younger males were much more likely to be low compliant with the recommendations, which was then echoed by a multitude of other studies following this one or in the subsequent months that were published. Another interesting association.
Just 1 minute left.
Yes. Another interesting association we found was for the support for discrimination, which was in the opposite direction. So people with higher stigmatizing attitudes were actually higher compliant. And this also leads to the implications and conclusions here. We found the traditional, or we corroborated traditional findings with higher risk aspects in young males, but also we found support for the othering hypothesis where higher stigmatization was associated with higher compliance. So it showed the functional properties of stigmatizing attitudes, at least for the beginning of the pandemic, which is quite an interesting finding and worthy of more discussion. So we conclude that future studies should use interventions that could promote advocacy and also pay close attention to social stigma, but then again, more closely investigate the positive functions of stigma in these contexts as well. That's it for the presentation. Thank you for the attention. These are the references that I presented.
Thank you, Samuel. Very, very interesting presentation and very interesting subject as well. Now we have time for a presentation from Pere Antoni Borràs from the University of Balearic Islands, Spain. And he's going to present effectiveness of a guided internet and mobile-based intervention for the prevention of unspecific low back pain in children. Study protocol of PEPE Multicenter Research.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Pere.
Thanks for your attention. Thanks for being here. And a good day to everyone, wherever you are in the world, because of this time schedule. Well, first of all, I want to a bit introduce the team and why I'm in this communication panel. It's because I'm not going to talk about COVID, but of course, everything is influenced by COVID. And in our research, we are normally intervening in school settings. So you can imagine that during all this pandemic, everything that was going to be in school was completely out of possibility. And we had to change a lot, and that's the idea to explain a little bit how a protocol that is a RCT, a randomized controlled trial, could be even administrated online, not in presence. That's the idea. Why? And why this project? And why doing postural education in primary education? And it's probably a non very common illness in the media, but as you can see, 70 to 80% of total population. I'm sorry, mates. 70 to 80% of you will suffer from low back pain during your life. It is what it is. So it's a really a major public health concern. And the point is that is the principal cause of sick leaves and temporary disabilities in middle and high income countries. And this has a super big effect in the financial situation of the budgets of a lot of companies and public enterprises. So here's a little bit the prevalence we have now. We are very used to this prevalence units. No? As you can have a look, below 7 years old, there's probably insignificant, something pretty normal. No? And from 60 to 70, you have the huge prevalence, whatever, men, women, regions, whatever. Is nobody is getting out of this low back pain. It's probably due to our specific morphology of our bodies that we are not really used to being walking in these 2 feet. And of course, it's due to the lack of not just physical activity, but, and what most important, physical fitness. In this matter, being active is not enough. You need to have a minimum of physical fitness to avoid having low back pain problems. But the point is that if you have a look, what not much people could even imagine is that from 7 to 8 years old, people start to have low back pain problems. So start to have episodes of low back pain problems. And what is have been demonstrated is that people with early episodes of low back pain will probably have and history of elevated low back pain in when they are when they grow up, no, when they are in the elderly. No? So, just to be quick, and this is a RCT, is a pragmatic multicenter trial, and tries to investigate this effect, no? But this derivative effect, because we are not going to deliver this intervention on site. No? Almost 1,000 students from 10 to 12 years old, and this age we have targeted as the probably most important because of the possibility of the understanding of how to use a backpack or everything related to backcare knowledge, etc. This knowledge about health and the daily habits and everything referred to ergonomy, how to weight, how to lift weights, how to transport objects, etc. One very important thing in this RCT is measuring physical fitness. But what is important in this panel is how we do this intervention. No? It is, of course, it's a data collection, it's intervention, and it's a follow-up. But this intervention is as in a school-based, but is carried out by the own teachers. As you probably may know, and most of the schools have created what they call bubbles. No? So they are in little groups with just one teacher for example, 10 to 12 kids. And what it could be the teacher that will be delivering physical education now is a responsible teacher for the whole group. And there's no more teacher for language or for music. And everybody's working with all the units and all the subjects in these bubbles. So the complicity of this situation have made up our minds to organize an intervention for the teacher to be delivered and through the families. So this is an intervention that comprises 12 weeks and is basically done in three levels. No? First of all, with the school and families, this is quite easy to reach because just preparing some triptychs, some posters, some information from the social network is pretty easy to reach the families. For the classroom teachers or the traditional teachers, there are online presentations that we can give them in regular basis, whatever they like. And for the PE teachers, of course, this nine online presentation show and the multi-subject teaching unit. This is a specific unit to be delivered at the school by them. But first of all, we do this online teaching. And then there's every week recorded presentations that they have just to remind them what to have to do every week. These all the presentations are based in the different areas that this intervention could affect, about anatomy, postural education, risk factors, and of course healthy habits to school, to home, in physical education. But probably the most successful is the correct use of backpacks. That it was, this one was very interesting for the families. These are some variables and some instruments that we are using in this study. But what is more important in terms of communication is that we have been creating this cartoon. It's called Belle. Belle is a short name for Elizabeth, no? Or Beth. It's called Belle Posture. No? So this cartoon is showing the kids how to use the correct use of the backpack, on what happens if sometimes I have an incident of low back pain, what do I have to do, what do I have to tell, etc., etc. No? So the idea was going through this cartoon, going very close to the children and trying probably to make them concerned about something that they will be not concerned at all. So having some back pain problems is not a big issue for them. And even it is not for you or for me or for us, no? Till you have a serious condition that you could probably not go to work one day or whatever. But in terms of global numbers or global health, low back pain is compromising a lot of sick leaveness and temporary disabilities and could affect a lot. This is some data about some addresses you can check, and if you want to have a look to I wanted to show you first this part of the website that is with all the resources the schools or the teachers or the families have, from the instruments for taking all the information that we need about questionnaires or about physical fitness. There's a video of every single physical test that they can perform because they have everything. So it's like developing a strategy on how you have to do everything by yourself, because you are not able, we are not able to deliver this intervention on a regular basis, no? For example. So this is it. So thank you very much. I just wanted to make you an overview on how we can organize and still do what we used to do, that is do school-based intervention in these times of pandemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pere, for sharing this interesting information and also for sticking to the time. Now we have the next presentation. We have, I don't know if he's here, from Kazakhstan, Samal Isarekova. Are you here?
Yeah, I am here.
Oh, good, it's true. Okay, I was thinking somebody wasn't here, but we are all here. Sorry. So she's going to present digital health literacy during COVID-19 pandemic among medical students in Kazakhstan pilot study. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good afternoon, dear colleagues. Yeah, my name is Samal Isabekova and I am a PhD student. Today, I'd like to show you our presentation about digital health literacy during COVID-19 pandemic among university students, medical students in Kazakhstan pilot study. And let me PhD student Marina Lopatina, Professor Orkan Okan, and Professor Kevin Dedakzinski. So COVID-19 is a respiratory infection caused by novel human coronavirus, and this disease emerged first in Wuhan in late December 2019. Despite geographical proximity to China and evolving the international relations, Kazakhstan is among the countries less affected by COVID-19. And the first confirmed case was detected in March 12, 2020 in Almaty city. And then starting March 16, 2020, all educational organizations in our country, schools, college, universities, were transitioned to online learning platform. Within a short period of time, a massive amount of web-based health-related information on COVID-19 became available. And this pandemic has been accompanied by infodemic and overabundance of valid and invalid health information on COVID-19. Therefore, health literacy, which is the ability to find, understand, and evaluate health information and apply it in daily decision-making and health behavior, is of utmost importance during the current pandemic. According to the health literacy study in 5 cities in Kazakhstan, we can do the following findings: that 2/3 of the respondents are free to operate on information in the field of health, but of the 1/3 respondents are difficult to obtain, understand, evaluate, and apply information. The importance of digital health literacy in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ability to find, understand, critical assess, and use information to make the health-related decisions. So university students comprises the population that primarily uses digital technologies. And the study I aim to evaluate digital health literacy related to COVID-19 and online information seeking behavior among university students in Kazakhstan. Social demographic information included sex, age, course study, subject of social status and financial condition of the students. The result of this study shows that a total of 742 students participated in this study, and average age was 22, and the most students were studying in bachelor's degree, 93.5%. In figure one, you can see gender of the participants, 66% female students and 34% male students. And also respondents were asked to position themselves at the step that best reflected their status in the social hierarchy, with higher values indicating and higher social status. So according to the previous study, respondents were categorized into three groups: low, middle, and high. Regarding subject of social status, 55.3% reported a low social status. A middle social status was 36.9%, and high social status was 7.8% of the students. And in the next slide, you can see figure number three. This figure shows the different dimension of the students, different dimension of digital health literacy among female students. And female students indicated that they most frequently had problems finding information on the internet about COVID-19, 2.6%. While writing on posts about COVID-19 was less difficult for female students, 1.6%. Across all dimensions, the greatest difficulties could be found to evaluate the reliability of information about COVID-19, 3.2%, and choosing the appropriate information about COVID-19 caused difficulties for approximately 0.6% of female students. And figure four shows the different dimension of digital health literacy among male students. Male students reported more difficulties in writing on posts about COVID-19, 6.8%. Almost 4% students had problems evaluating the reliability of information about COVID-19, and while 2.8% of the male students had problem with finding information about COVID-19, and choosing the appropriate information about this disease caused difficulties for 1.7% of male students. For the all of students deciding if the information they found is applicable and applying the information in their daily life and using the information they found to make decision about their health, for example, we can say protective measures and hygiene rules, methods of transmission of the virus, risk and their prevention were not very difficult. Because, for example, you can see in figure five for female students and figure six for male students that the percentage of the result are not high. So regarding the topics, respondents stated that the most frequently searched for information on the current spread of COVID-19 and also symptoms of COVID-19 and restrictions, current situation assessment, recommendation, transmission routes of COVID-19, individual measures to protect against infection, hygiene regulation, and coping with psychological stress caused by COVID-19 were also interesting for students, medical students in Kazakhstan. In last figure, number seven, shows the satisfaction of the students with the information about COVID-19. And the result shows that the majority of female students, 58.2%, were partly satisfied with the quality of the received information, and 13.4% were satisfied with the quality of this information. But 17.8% of the students were dissatisfied with the quality of their information, and 10.8% female students were very dissatisfied with the quality of their safe information about COVID-19. And the result among male students are similar. So the majority of male students, 46%, were partly satisfied with the quality of their information, 12.4% satisfied, and while 23.6% of male students were dissatisfied with the quality of this information, and 18% of the students were very dissatisfied with the quality of this information about COVID-19. In conclusion, we can say that across all dimensions, the greatest difficulties for female students could be found to evaluate the reliability of information about COVID-19, 3.2%, while male students reported more difficulties in writing on posts about COVID-19 than female students, 6.8%. And for all of students, deciding if the information they found is applicable, applying the information in their daily life, and using the information to make decisions about their health were not very difficult. Also, respondents stated that they most frequently search for information on the current spread of COVID-19. And also, such topics were interesting for students, like symptoms, I said about it, yes, restrictions, current situation assessment, recommendation, transmission, individual measures to protect against infection, hygiene regulation, and coping with psychological stress caused by COVID-19. The majority of students, 52.1% of the response, were partly satisfied with the quality of their safe information about COVID-19, but 14.4% of the participants were very dissatisfied. Despite a good level of digital health literacy among respondents due to their medical background, still they face complications in identifying reliable sources of information. Further large scale research is needed to provide representative data and policy measures to improve students' health literacy at a time of risk of spreading infectious disease, in particular COVID-19. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Samai.
Yeah.
Thank you for your presentation, very interesting, and also for sticking to the time. Now we still have two more presentations. The next one is from Jana Lehmann from Bochum, Germany. She's explaining collaborative research for health promotion in times of COVID-19. Thank you, Jana.
Yes, thank you. Wait a moment, please. So can you see the presentation now? Yeah? Okay, thank you. So hello everybody and greetings from Germany. I'm the second one from Germany here I see. And we are a research group from the University of Applied Sciences in Bochum in Germany. And we are doing research in the field of municipal health promotion. And my name is Jana Lehmann and I'm one of the scientific staff members. And I will present to you our contribution on the topic of collaborative research for implementing municipal health promotion in times of COVID-19. So this contribution is about health communication in a more broader sense, I think. So for the background, the municipality as a living environment and its influence on health has increasingly moved into focus in recent years, because the municipality is a so-called umbrella setting, as it includes many other settings. And the municipal setting plays a big role in health promotion because you have the opportunity to reach people in their daily living environment. And so it provides the opportunity to also reach vulnerable target groups, so older or younger, or people with a migration background. And those vulnerable target groups are often not reached by health promotion measures. to support actors in developing and implementing appropriate health promoting actions in municipalities. Concrete strategies are needed. And for example, in the development of strategies or recommendations, the participation of the actors is very important to ensure the practical relevance of those. And this is a little bit difficult right now due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so it had also be adjusted. So this is why we are working in an international research project right now with 13 European countries. And the main goal of the whole project is to develop recommendations which are intended to contribute to reaching vulnerable groups and are relevant for politics and practice. And the entire process of the project is divided into several steps which were designed collaboratively as far as possible, and they took place digitally due to the pandemic. To give you an overview, in a first step, we made a rapid review on strategies for creating healthy living environments in the municipality that was prepared, and then we conducted interviews with experts in the field of municipal health promotion. To gather information on various aspects of health promotion, particularly in relation to activities that the interviewees were implementing with the goal of implementing municipal health promoting measures. So based on these first two steps, theses on relevant topics of municipal health promotion were developed by us as the researchers, and they were further developed in an online workshop as a preparation for use in a final two-stage Delphi study. And as I already mentioned, the final goal where we are working on right now is to develop recommendations for policy and practice. And in this presentation, I would like to go more into detail about the design of the online workshop as a preparation for the Delphi study. So the workshop was selected as a collaborative approach to bundle and use the knowledge of the participants. And the participants were experts and practitioners on the field of municipal health promotion. And on the basis of the rapid reviews and the interviews as the first two steps that I mentioned, 22 theses were created or developed and in the following six areas, which were reaching vulnerable groups, networks, analysis and strategy development, guiding principle, implementation and evaluation. And for our workshop, 12 theses were selected and divided into four breakout sessions. The workshop was held with 16 participants of 9 European countries. Due to the short time, there were only 4 breakout rooms. And here you can see the titles of the rooms, which included all previously mentioned topics. The 4 rooms were about networks, analysis and strategy development, specifying cross-phase principles and implementation and evaluation. The total duration of our workshop was 19 minutes. We had 15 minutes for introduction and information for the participants. We had 16 minutes for the breakout sessions and 15 minutes for a plenary discussion at the end. And there was a change of the breakout sessions after 20 minutes each. And in total, there were 3 changes. The participants remained in the small groups for the whole process, and we had 1 researcher from us per room to document the discussion points on a digital whiteboard, and also we had some guiding questions to stimulate the exchange during the discussion on this whiteboard. As one result in view to this workshop, we can say that the exchange in small groups was experienced as very profitable. It led to a good exchange, a good discussion. We had some critical examination of the topics. We had new perspectives and aspects from the experts and the practitioners. We had contributions of country-specific aspects, which we wanted to know. And so all in all, it was a fruitful exchange among those international experts and practitioners. And this enabled us to concretize the thesis, which we used we needed for the Delphi study. We had also some new impulses for the participants, what they could transfer directly into their practical work. There was a great interest in a timely summary of the results because the participants wanted to be able to try out and implement some aspects directly after this workshop. And so the workshop enabled an international exchange despite the COVID-19 pandemic, and this was also associated only with little effort for the participants. So during the implementation, we also have made some experiences what is considered and needed when implementing such a workshop. For example, you need a suitable online tool like Zoom we are using right now. You need human resources to accompany the individual groups and, if necessary, to guide the exchange during the discussion and the discussion and to note the results. If necessary, you need some technical support during the workshop. And for the preparation of the contents, you need time for collegial exchange if necessary. Time and human resources also for recruiting and educating the participants, and also time and human resources for the prompt processing of the results so that you can make a rapid transfer in practice possible. So as a conclusion for this workshop, as one step of our collaborative project, the implementation of an online workshop, you can say, is a promising and also feasible way to involve experts in research, give them a voice, and foster the international networking and exchange, especially in times of COVID, where only online formats are possible right now. And this way to include those experts and practitioners contributes to the practical relevance and the transferability of the objectives. And so we think it increases the acceptance and the motivation of them on those integrated and the addressed people. So I just hurried up a little bit. So then we have time for discussion. So we're at the end of the presentation. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jana. Super interesting presentation, also showing how COVID has shown us how to use all these devices, no, to communicate. It's interesting in research. Okay, so now we have the last presentation, and by Victoria Porté from Agencia de Salud Pública de Barcelona. So she's a colleague from Maribel. And she's not going to be here, but we're going to share her video explaining community intervention to address problematic alcohol consumption. So I'm going to share the presentation. I hope I do it well. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Okay. Yeah. No. I try again because I need to put the share sound. Okay.
Hi, my name is Victoria Porté, and I am presenting community intervention to address problematic alcohol consumption. As a background, just to say, Barcelona Saludos Bar is a community action strategy aiming to reduce inequalities in health in disadvantaged neighborhoods. In this framework, problematic alcohol consumption was identified in several neighborhoods. So as a next step, we'll review evidence on effective community-based intervention to reduce adult alcohol consumption, and we identify three common components: community mobilization, media campaign, and law enforcement. As a general objectives, we are trying to prevent and reduce problematic alcohol consumption and encourage risk perception about alcohol misuse. Our specific objectives are to increase knowledge and risk perception about alcohol consumption, to strengthen the screening and referral of risky consumers, to strengthen law enforcement on alcohol availability, and to reduce neighborhood environmental exposure to alcohol advertising. In our methods, the design of this study is a quasi-experimental pre-post study with a comparison group. You can see on your right the maps where you where the intervention neighbors are in green. They are the Turo de la Peira and Campeguera, and the control group is La Verneda in the San Martí district. This neighborhood was selected according to the health priority in the participatory diagnosis, where problematic alcohol consumption was one of the first problems identified, clinical indicators associated with alcohol consumption, socioeconomic indicators, and also feasibility. This intervention is a community participatory design that included established a community steering group called AXIO. Then this group defined the objectives and the actions of the intervention, and finally we established an evaluation plan. As you can see above, the evaluation plan is organized according to the specific objectives, and also have different instruments where you can see that we are going to develop a questionnaire. We are going to collect secondary data whenever it's possible, and also we are going to perform some observations. And these instruments are going to be pre-post whenever possible, sometimes only post, depending on the action we are going to implement. And also we are going to implement most of them in the intervention and the control group, but the actions, the specific actions, they are going to be only implemented in the intervention group. So our first result is the steering group itself. We've been meeting, say the first meeting was on January 2020 last year. And so far we've been meeting for 7 meetings around, we have held seven meetings, and we are around 10, 12 professionals working in the territory who represents around 10 different resources of the neighborhoods or city assets. For example, social services, local police, health services, the district itself, etc., etc. And despite the limitation derived from the COVID-19 pandemic, the working group defined several actions that were validated and consensus and they are organized by the different components that I mentioned before. Regarding the community mobilization component, we have a film and alcohol festival at the Civic Center. We also prepare a community video that gathers the opinion of the neighbors on alcohol consumption. And we are now working on some preventive actions during the neighborhood celebrations in summer that follows and respect the COVID-19 protocols. Regarding the screening and referral A component at the health center, Capturo, we've been able to designate the nurse responsible for the detection and brief alcohol intervention program, that is a regional program in Catalonia, not only in Barcelona. For the communication campaign, we are working on a district and neighborhood alcohol preventive campaign. The video is part of this element too, or this component. And finally, regarding the component of law enforcement, we are working on special agreements between local businesses, local police, and neighbors to increase alcohol law information and risk perception on alcohol consumption. So we also been able to do some of the observations previous intervention. As I mentioned before, the observations are going to be performing different census tracts, also in the intervention and in the control group. We are using data for the data collection. We use an instrument developed by another colleagues in Spain, that collects these three indicators, the availability, the advertising of alcohol, and the signs of consumption. And what we see, we perform the observations at the beginning of this year, 2021. And at the intervention neighborhood, we collect 199 total references and 125 at the control group, control neighborhood. And despite these differences in the total references, what we found mainly is that the intervention neighborhood has very specific specific cluster of premises concentrated in one area nearby a park that announce or has special offers related with the botellón. The botellón is a practice that people do to meet up and drink in public spaces. And these special offers in the intervention neighborhood are at very low price, and they organize everything you need to drink in a public space, no? The glasses, the ice, the alcohol, etc. No? And also we found more observations in the intervention neighborhood related to the signs of consumptions, that means the empty cans and bottles, no? That they were seems not to be so present in the control group. So we can say we can say up to now that we have some lessons learned and some assets identified in our design. One is that the steering group performance was based on the identified health priorities, relying on evidence to define the actions and the experience of the professionals working in the territory. And the other asset is that this is a community, a multi-component community intervention on alcohol that is one of the first in our environment. But we are also very aware that we have big challenges. And one of it is that we have to overcome the limitations imposed by the pandemic, but we are very optimistic about this. We have also to increase neighbors' direct participation, because now we are mainly professionals working at the steering working group. And we have also a big challenge to evaluate the impact of the actions designed for the intervention. But we believe that implementing a community-based intervention to address alcohol use is particularly relevant, because community interventions are effective in addressing problematic alcohol, and also because the economic crisis that we learned in the past, or we lived in the past too, we have learned that they have an impact on alcohol consumption, and they also alter the patterns of consumption. So we have to be prepared for the next scenario we might have, we don't know yet. So that's it. Thank you to everyone for your attention. This is my mail. Please, if you have any question or commentary, please do write me. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, so this was Esther, a very nice presentation also. And I think now we can just spend the last minutes we have, almost 20, 25 minutes for discussion. And Maribel, I believe she has put some questions on the chat already for the people who have presented. Maribel?
Yes, there are more questions in the chat, and to begin, I have put three. I can begin with Samali Sarikova. Yes. I ask because in your study is based in university population, and we can assume that this type of population is the best to understand. No, to have a good literacy in the digital, no, with digital technologies. And my question was, what about recommendations, no? What taking your study into account, no? What recommendation do you consider important when we want to use digital technologies? Because we want, no, in health promotion, but with populations that we can assume that the barriers are higher.
Mm-hmm. I think that often older people, older adults, and some people with the chronic diseases, and the people with low condition, financial condition, may have problem with the digital technology or total with the health literacy. And it is my opinion that I think that first, we can organize some special schools for these people. For example, in our country, we have a lot of special health schools where some people can take the questions, correct question about their health, some advices from specialists, yes, and also can learn some and can take some information, education about digital technology also. It is first, it's my opinion. And also the students, yes, the students have a lot of, skills about digital health literacy, about digital devices, and they can help their parents or relatives or some older pupils for teaching them, about digital digital health literacy. And last, my opinion about TV and radio, because most of the older people use these devices for in every day, yes, and we can organize some special programs, special programs for these people, for example, and they can receive, they can take answer for their question about health, about digital health.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Another question for the second, for Suraya Said Mohamed, from the experience of Malaysia.
Okay.
You comment in your presentation, no, about the, okay, the district reduction program.
All right, thanks for the questions. Basically, the district risk reduction program is community mobilization and empowerment. Basically, the coordinator is the district health authorities, but the community themselves that manage the program to protect the family, their neighborhoods, and also the district. So they will be given missions for each week to be carried out in their district. If there is case, the district is going to be yellow, so they have to turn the yellow status to the green back within 14 days. That's the target. So so there are district-based health promotions and community engagement activities.
Okay, thank you very much. And Pere Borràs? You answered me by personal, and I was thinking in Barcelona. I am not working in this topic now, but years ago it was a problem, the weight of the, no, the backpacks for children to go to a school. And my question was about if in your intervention, who has taken in account this topic specific with teachers who are responsible or part of the responsible of the weight of the backpacks.
Definitely. Thank you, Maribel. Definitely, this is a highlight. This is a very important question. And more important than the teachers are the families. And also the school administrators, because very few schools have cabinets. I mean, they have places to leave some of the staff at the school. So most of the children are asked to carry with a lot of weight. I mean, even now that most of them are using computers, they're still carrying a lot of weight, carrying a lot of weight. In our preliminary data and other studies we have been carried out, the recommended measure that is less than 10% of the total body weight of the kid is always above that. It's if you start weighting the backpacks of the kids, it's always above that level. Oh, there is 10%. Imagine a 30 kilo kid that is quite enormous. It's just 3 kilos for the backpack, and this is very easily to reach upon that. The point is, the work here is has to be done at three levels again, to the school administrator, to ask them if they can allow the people to leave things at school with some safety. Also to the families, that be conscious that probably they don't have to carry everything all the time back and forth to school. And also to the specific teachers, try to rely more on technology, because what we have learned during this pandemic is that a lot of things we can rely on technology. And that's why this panel is so important, no? Of course, this is also always a big issue, and so it's not probably the main cause for causing back pain in children and adults, but this is a multi-component disease, no? So it's one of them, and as many as we can address, we'll be more successful in avoiding this burden. Thank you, Maribel.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. Well, there are more questions in the chat. We don't know if you can take profit for these different experiences and variables.
I wanted to ask a question to Samuel, if it's possible.
Thanks.
Great.
Good.
It's about this question you've been showing us the data. I was wondering do you think that people tend to answer in a social desirable way, no? Because came to my mind as was very interesting that the skin contact was the item, no, that was pointing in the low average. Do you think that people tend to answer these questions as a like a so what the other people want to hear, and if we could be able to observe, make an observation of these people, we would have a different data.
Samuel?
Of course, that's a good question. I think social desirability is always an issue when you work with questionnaires in any case. So that's true, but it was also quite surprising that some of the values were rather low for people, because if we argue social desirability, we would expect much higher scores for most items. So much higher compliance, which we did not find, and other studies didn't either. But then again, it would be desirable to have different types of measures, of course, and observations of behaviors. I totally agree to include at best both of them. So reported behaviors and also observed behaviors, but this is hard to do for all these types of behaviors. There are, I know, some studies that use, for example, hand sanitizers, and they measure hand sanitizing behaviors and then ask people about this, and they triangulate this data, but it is difficult for other types. In this case, the skin contact was also not only contact with other people, but also with one's own skin. So less touching one's face, for example, and other areas of skin, which was recommended at the beginning. And I assume that this type of behavior is harder to change and then others, because you just tend to, let's say, touch your nose or your eyes at some point. So people maybe did not differentiate it as much in the item. So this could also be a methodological limitation there.
Thanks. Nobody asked more questions.
I have a question for Jana, if nobody else has any other. I was, Jana, I know your objective today was to present something like just about the new way to do these meetings, no? But I wanted to know, like, in your research which, as a whole, what you think is the municipality belief on their responsibility in health promotion? Maybe your perception on whether are they happy to participate? Is it easy to engage them?
So it's like, I think half and half. It's a big challenge to take part, but it is also a big opportunity. But when you think on all those different strategies, like health and all policies and so on, there's a lot what has to happen so that it works in the way it should work. So this is why we are working on recommendations, because we see that there are so many problems in using the municipality in the opportunity that it is. You need someone who says, okay, we tried this, or you have good practice things which you can do, because most of the people we were in contact with need some help in form like recommendations. So we think they are very happy and see those opportunities, but sometimes it is really like it's really hard, and you need long breath to work on it and work on it. And when you have some, for example, struggle with politics who say, okay, you're working on health promotion, so where are the results? Because they think like it's in medicine. You're doing something and 2 weeks later, probably you have a result and everybody says, hey, now I'm healthier. Because in municipal health promotion, everything lasts longer and you see the good results some month or even years later. So it's like a hard way, but I think everybody sees those possibilities. And so all the European countries and the municipalities are very happy to have this opportunity to change and be in contact also with other countries.
Yeah, that's great. Do you have like in a Spanish municipality involved? Just curiosity.
Yes, we have.
Okay, great.
Well, we are on time. Thank you very much. No, Angelina, we can.
Yeah.
Thanks your presentations and for the assistance.
Yeah, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.